things that you heard this morning thematically regarding empire and kingdom and how business kind of works with two different kinds of mindsets. The way that we're going to structure today's session is it's going to be discussion and story-based. So we'll be telling a lot of stories, we'll be having some discussions, and we encourage you guys to ask questions if something's unclear, or something doesn't sit right, or if something just doesn't kind of like, you know, mesh well. That's the best way for this to work, in that we learn as much from you guys as we hope you're going to learn from us. So again, feel free to participate in the discussion. The takeaways we have from this are, first, we want to show you contrasts between the empire model and the kingdom model. A lot of this is going to be intuitive to you because of what you've heard from all the sessions this morning. I can tell that everyone has a really good background in these two mentalities. The second thing we want you to take away is a real-world model that demonstrates kingdom principles in business. And Jeff and I have started a company where we implement, in a practical sense, some of the things you're going to see today. Okay? And finally, practical and implementable ideas to use in your sphere of influence. And we recognize that some people have influence over entire organizations. Some of them may be departments, and some of them may be just your little area of work, which is fine. But there's a way to scale up and scale down the ideas we have here so they're relevant to your sphere of influence. And those are what we hope you can take away from this. Okay? Mm-hmm. So, I speak too much, so.
Oh, you're going to make me do it this time?
I enjoyed it.
The important part about the expectation is just that it's important that you guys get something from this, because we've heard this before. So feel free to interrupt or whatever, because again, we're here for you guys. So just feel comfortable doing that.
Excellent.
And we have a lot of fun stuff to share. So.
Yes, excellent. So I know most people dislike PowerPoint. This is just a backdrop for discussion, by the way. So I'm putting this as contents and not agenda. So let me just make a confession. This morning, I told them that this would be a backdrop and we would kind of refer to these as we went, but it ended up becoming what drove the whole presentation. But it seemed to work okay. If that doesn't work, we'll adjust. But what I'd like to get through are, again, the empire versus kingdom models, the driving forces, so what the differences are in driving forces between the empire and the kingdom, the mentality, so kind of how this affects mindsets and mentalities, how the abundance model works in your kingdom, so how abundance is modeled in your kingdom. So that's one of the first steps toward practicality, and we're going to show you exactly how we model abundance in our company. The second is, how does an organization function in the kingdom? So we're going to show you practically how we structure our organization as well. This is where a lot of the questions come into play as well, because the paradigm shift on these two things in particular is pretty dramatic and pretty stark. And finally, who is threatened by the kingdom model? Because with change, with any kind of like a transformation or paradigm shift, someone is threatened. And we have to recognize that and not see them as like the enemy or anything like that, or something bad, but some way that we can kind of bring those kinds of threatened individuals around to this model.
So. Maybe you want to do an introduction?
Oh, yeah, good idea. Right.
Oh, good idea. Yeah, you do.
Okay, so I'm Leon Liu. I've been doing operations consulting for about 20 years. Consultants is a bit of a charged word. Earlier today, Jason said I do cost reduction and changed it to productivity, so thank you very much.
You did great.
Yeah, you did awesome. So he upgraded that term, which was another charged term in some ways. But what we've done, basically, in the past is transformation through cultural change. And what that means is we're not experts. So I'm going to say two things that are going to scare you off the bat. We're not experts at anything, and we don't have the answers. So if you want to leave now, you can go figure yourself. But bottom line is, when we go to a customer or a client, we start off the bat. We tell them immediately, we're not experts. We don't have the answers either. But what we do bring is, we facilitate a process to bring your team along to help design solutions. And that's always, in our opinion, the best way to create solutions. It generates ownership, and it includes the expert's opinion, people doing the work. So that's kind of what our method is. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah? Yeah. Well, just one thing, too. Talk about how, how God works in things. I've worked for a couple of large corporations and worked my way to the top. And, I just was in a board meeting, and have any of you used Charlie Brown's cartoon?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the parents, the wah, 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 wah. I literally heard that at a board meeting one day, and I thought, I can't do this anymore. Mm. So I got up and left. And like 2 weeks later, someone heard that I quit, and they said, hey, I got this company to start, I just took over the CEO, it's in shambles. I was a process guy. He says, can you come help me fix it? And I'm like, well, I'll come help you as a friend, but I'm not interested in ever working for a company again. And he said, that's great. We'll hire you as a consultant. And 30 years later, here we are, still doing the same thing, making changes. And it's all the changes that we do, that we base in Lean on Kind of Mission, we get a team together, it's all based on the humans. It's not based on the business, it's based on humans. That's really the differentiator between us and other consulting firms.
He's a bit humble. He started on the shop floor, by the way. He worked his way all the way up to executive management. And I'm sure when he left that boardroom, everyone was chasing him, saying, don't leave, please don't leave.
Yeah, the truth of the story is I stood up and told them all, and I thought some of those people were my friends, actually, because, you know, we'd spend time together, families and stuff. Not one of them said, hey, what do you mean, where are you going? Mm-hmm. Nobody said a word, and I walked right out that door. I guarantee you, before I even got in the car, there was someone sitting in that chair.
Yeah.
I mean, so that was a real eye-opener. That's why I said I'd never work for another company again. I just couldn't do it.
Excellent.
Yeah, thanks for reminding me of that.
Yeah, so that's our origin story, so to speak. Actually, let me back a little bit and give you a bit more of the origin story. So I graduated from college, went to go work for a company that actually has a facility in Bristol. And, you know, I was the smart wunderkind flying around the world solving problems. And, you know, I'd get phone calls in the middle of the night from Asia or Singapore or whatever, and I'd, you know, complain to my friends about how, you know, how guys and people are calling me. Secretly, I was like, oh man, I'm important, right? What I realized later, though, was that people started to resent me, and the solutions that I implemented, no matter how clever they were, would never stick. Yeah. And it was because they never owned them, right? They were my solutions, and I was giving it to them. I was the expert. And so I changed my habits and changed everything around. At the time, Jeff was actually consulting for the company I was working with, and I was trying to dodge him the whole time. So I had met his counterparts, and I was like, look, I'm not interested in meeting any more consultants. And so I avoided him for like 2 years. Changed apps and came to the company, working mostly in Europe, and then someone asked me to meet a consultant, and it happened to be Jeff. And I had no choice but to meet him this time around. So he comes around, and I had changed my approach by then to one that's more team-based. And so the timing was perfect, because when we met, I could tell immediately that his approach and the way that I wanted to do business in the future was very aligned. And for 20 years, we've been working together ever since. And that's kind of how the origin story worked for Jeff and
Liam. You know, it just dawned on me what Jonathan was talking about. You know, timing, God's timing's right. And the first time...
I don't think I'd be ready.
First time you wouldn't have been interested. And then eventually he came and worked for us, and we've transformed hundreds of companies using this philosophy.
Been awesome.
Yeah.
Excellent. Empire versus kingdom. This is, again, the dichotomy that I know that all of you are familiar with and hearing about. So we're going to contextualize it into the business world. So there are two paradigms, obviously. And let me ask you a question. In the empire, who is your audience? Who are you performing, so to speak, for?
Your boss.
Your boss, right. That's a big one, right? And who defines success in that case? It's your boss, right? Who else is your audience in the empire, though? Aside from your boss, because your boss is a big audience there, right? You're performing for them, you want to get the promotion, you want to make sure you're shown as being worthy. Who else is a part of your audience?
Shareholders.
Anyone that sits there and can judge your performance based on a measurable is part of the audience, okay? Now, in the kingdom, who is your audience? Who do you perform for?
God.
Or anybody in general? Possibly just God, right? Your responsibility in the kingdom is to do your role as a human being with the identity you are given to the best of your ability, right? And that's all that matters. And what is, it sounds easy to do, right? Just be yourself. But the empire almost forces you to do something different, okay? So let me give you a little quote here. So a pyramid can be created from all the entities in existence, sort of by the amounts of respect you have for their opinions. At the very top, people that you really care about their opinions. At the very bottom, people you don't really care about. So you can see how it would be a pyramid, right? There are very few people that you really actually care about their opinions on. And at the bottom, you have, for more, you know, for, I guess, all intents and purposes, the mob. So if you sort them by this level of importance, which portion's approval do you seek? Right? Is it the people at the top? Or is the mob? Is the majority? Oftentimes it's the majority, right? So let me ask you a question. Do you know what the most desired career is for a teenager these days?
Influencer.
Yes. Social media influencer. So who do you think they're serving? Who's their audience?
The mob.
It's the mob, right? I mean, you can't blame them, right? This is kind of what they're indoctrinated into from a very young age. But this is how I get my validation. an external source. And so, if the mob decides who you should be, what's your identity become? Whatever the mob wants, right? Hey, I put out this video about this, and my view count went down, so what are you going to be trained to do? To try and chase those views, right? Chase those subscribers or whatever it is. So at the end of the day, who do you serve? Do you serve the mob, or do you serve something greater than that, right? So that's just a question to kind of consider. I'm going too fast, let me know. Just had coffee. How do you keep score? What is the score from the empire? How do you keep score? Money. Yes, countables. Money is a big one, right? It's a very easy way to keep score. What are the things can you use to keep score?
Titles,
status, all those things that the empire confers upon you as telling you what kind of value you have, right? And what does success look like in that case? What does success look like in the empire model?
Money,
possessions, the house, the car, whatever it is. Jeff, tell me how much happiness did that bring you in your life?
And I'm not going to put it on me, but I've coached a lot of CEOs, a lot of people that have a lot of money. They have a great life, and they're the most miserable people I've ever met in my life. Right? So, I mean, they actually jump out windows, if you think about it. So in my life, I learned that that actually, you know, produced nothing. I had all that stuff, a big house, big car. I even smelled good, right? And I was miserable. I sat in my car one time in the garage, and I thought to myself, if I had a gun, I'd probably shoot myself. My life was great. I had a great job. Like him, I rose up the ranks really fast. Everything was fine. I actually pulled out of my driveway. I didn't even go inside the house. Pulled my driveway. We had facilities all over. And just went somewhere else. Distracted myself from it. And that's what we do, right? And the enemy loves that, right? Distracted. Separation. Wants to separate us from that.
But he had the adoration of the mob.
Oh, yeah. Everyone thought I was cool.
Loved his life. They thought he was a success story, right? But deep inside, there were, you know, people were hollow, right?
Yeah.
My mother once told me, the easiest problems to solve in this world are the ones that take money to solve, right? Yeah. And so if you think about it, if you're rich, what kind of problems do you have left? The ones you can't solve with money.
Yeah. When I walked out of that boardroom and I got on the plane, I'm not bragging, but I had a private plane because they were flying me back and forth. And I got on the plane, I said, this will be the last flight you take me on. He said, what? And I told him what I did. He said, you're out of your mind? What are you? And everyone said that. Are you crazy? It was the best thing ever happened.
So, true service does not need to be visible or celebrated. I mean, yes?
I don't know if I missed something earlier, but I don't know what your training is, your profession, your work is, and it seems like it would help me in the context. Are you an engineer? Are you... Just to try to understand the context of what you're putting these experiences in.
That's a good question. So we're operations consultants. So typically you go into companies, either manufacturing, service-based, transactional, whatever, and we help them create value from the processes. It sounds pretty generic, but if there's a company and there's a problem, we'll go in there and we'll facilitate solutions with teams. So we're consultants at the end of the day.
Like efficiency engineers, would that be a similar
that
thing?
Is in the same vein of what we do.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's really hard because a lot of the words that are like used these days to describe consultants, I'd say 99% of them probably have negative connotations associated with them, but that would be an accurate description of what we do. So,
what would be a problem that you might go in and solve?
Right, so let's say, for example, I'll give you a real example. There was a company in North Carolina, they made surge protectors, and it's a product that's very easily outsourced to China. And so, we took a look at the numbers, and we were talking to the private equity that owned them, and we told them, listen, if we can improve productivity by 15%, it makes sense to keep that manufacturing in America. And the PE said, hey, if you can do 10%, we'll keep it here. And so we'll go in there, and we'll work with the teams, and we'll figure out a way to do that. And sure enough, what we did was, so I guess,
that's
not what
story.
We did, but it was in Zebulon, because I was Zebulon, North Carolina. We worked with them, and within 3 days, we had improved productivity about 50%. Reduced work in process inventory 98%. And not only did they not outsource the material, they stopped the contract in China and repatriated that work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of work that we do. But it's a good question.
So did they hire you to come in and look at this problem, or you looked at their company and approached them?
That's a good question. We had a connection with the private equity that owned them. So long resume type story, but I'll make it short. I worked within a company that was owned by private equity for a while, and they had a company in We had a business unit in Miami that I was kind of helping to run out. They were going to shut them down. Within the span of about 6 months, we made our first profit ever. 2 years, we doubled, tripled revenues, and put our biggest competitor out of business. So the private equity remembered kind of what I had facilitated, because again, I can't take credit for any of the work that was done there. And they've known Jeff as well, and so they recruited us to take a look at what was going on over there. Because it's a big decision, right? Big risk to move it offshore.
The company themselves might not, they've already made a decision, so it makes sense.
Typically they do, they wanted a cross-check, and if it's a risky decision where you can only go with like a one-way door, they typically get someone to take a look at it just to kind of cross-check it. So that's what we do.
You know, it's expensive, right, to move all that stuff over there. And their thought was, you know, remove the waste out of the process before we move it to China. Right, get it out of there. And then everyone, it was really interesting. I love the people. Was it North Carolina?
Zebulon.
They're just awesome. They were awesome people. Everyone knew that their jobs were going to go away. They knew it. But they worked so hard. We didn't tell them. We had no idea that the PE firm was going to keep it. Right. We had no idea. And they did, and they did. It was
amazing. It's amazing. Like, within, like, the span of, like, a day or so, it went from despondent to, like, excited to, like, just absolutely ecstatic. It was pretty cool. People coming to work smiling again. It was.
When we went through the process, we actually cleared up a lot of the space in the building that they were in, so they were able to move that stuff from China. They didn't have to buy another building. Yeah. And guess what? Those people that worked so hard, they benefited from that.
Yeah.
Right? It's amazing.
Right, so true service is not even visible or celebrated. And again, we can think of many examples of people that are visible and celebrated for possibly empire-based metrics, but a person nobly serves by humbly using the knowledge, gifts, and resources they are given to serve in their own way and own capacity. In the empire, what you receive can be considered rewards, right? Like your money. This is my reward for doing a good job. In the kingdom, they're resources. So they're responsibilities now. You get these resources, and that gives you a greater ability to amplify what you're given, right? To amplify your abilities and your identity to do more good in the world. That's how we see resources in the kingdom, okay? What is the currency of the empire? It's a pretty obvious one. Like, what's the currency of the empire? What makes the empire work?
Productivity,
all the measurables, money, etc., right? And the currency of the kingdom, it's a little more nebulous, right? Can anyone give me some ideas of what the currency of the kingdom might be?
Life transformation.
Transformation, right? Elevating people, joy, that kind of stuff that's immeasurable is the currency of the kingdom, okay?
Yeah.
Any questions so far, or any more questions? So, the driving forces. Anybody know who Adam Smith is? Yes, sir.
He's our economist from, I guess, the 1800s, that sort of instituted free market. I mean, the concept
capitalism,
of free market.
Right, right. Yeah. Do you remember what force he...
The invisible hand.
Invisible hand, exactly right. Are you all aware of the invisible hand? Mm-hmm. Basically, this is the invisible force that drives economies or companies. And it's about profit motive, right? So it's the pursuit of profit that will drive innovation, optimization, efficiency, etc., and spawn new businesses. That was the theory behind what Adam Smith was saying. Do you know who this is? Eli Goldratt? Anybody know? Anybody heard of the book The Goal? Okay. So in the book The Goal, what he states as the goal of business is to make a profit. The goal of business is to make a profit, okay? There's nothing wrong with making a profit. Earlier in the session, I demonized profit way too much, so I'm gonna try and make amends now. Profit's not a bad thing, right? But it shouldn't be the focus of what you're doing, and I'll get to the reason why later. Eli Goldratt wrote a very popular book, The Goal, and in it, there were two main concepts. One was called the theory of constraints, which I won't worry about. The second one, again, was that the goal of all businesses is to make a profit. Finally, Gordon Gekko. Anybody know who that is? Okay, right, Wall Street, right? And what was his famous line?
Greed
is good. Exactly, greed is good. Now, none of these statements have any negative spin or connotation in the empire. This is what it's all about. It's all about making money, right? However, in the kingdom, instead of having the invisible hand drive things, you have your true identity drive things, okay? Instead of having the goal being to make money, the goal is your purpose. So after you identify your true identity, you pursue a purpose based upon that. And what drives is your mission and your calling. So it's a very different, I guess, influence or a very different goal, objective that you're going after. I mentioned earlier that these things right here are empire-based, and there's nothing wrong with that. But think about it. We indoctrinate people from a very young age into that model, right? The way they're educated. Think about your children. They grow up, and your preoccupation is that they get good grades, so they can go to a good college, so they can get a good career, and they can make money for themselves. I mean, it's all about career. Where's the purpose in that, though? What do we prioritize? Do we prioritize their income or their happiness? You know, those are questions we have to ask about empire versus kingdom.
A good example for that was spoke at a commencement, college commencement of the engineering school. And, you know, we said the speech or whatever, and then some of the kids came down and was asking more questions. And the ones I could see, we were talking to them, and one of them said, you know, I really don't want to be an engineer. And then the other one said, yeah, me either. And, you know, he's just like, oh my goodness, I'm sure your parents are close. Right? Hearing that. But it's like, well, why are you doing this? Mm-hmm. Well, my father was, my grandfather was. A couple of them said, you know, I want a big car and a big house. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh, there's a distinct difference between chasing money, right, and chasing fulfillment, right? And so the lesson in this is that if you're having a purpose in your life, and that's what I was really speaking about, was having purpose. That's what drove them to the stage. And they said, well, you know, I want to be a painter or something. I can't remember. It was something obscure. And I'm like, well, you can still use your engineering for that purpose. So none of this is a waste. Just like in the Bible where it says, you know, God uses all things for good, right? And again, it's a perspective. And
in fact, nothing is a waste, period, because it's all part of the journey.
Jonathan did a great job on this.
Yeah, exactly. It's all part of the journey. Your experience is shaping you, right, into the tool that you're going to be needed for your purpose later on. So I think one of the biggest mistakes parents can make is wanting their children to become better versions of themselves versus helping them become who they are, right? And so this is where we get into that problem. Hey, I want you to be a better version of me so you can make more money, don't just suffer like I did, or whatever it is, where this is where true happiness really lies, right? It's very difficult to break that paradigm, especially since we're taught that in all of our institutions almost.
Leon, yes. A clarifying question between purpose, mission, and calling. So can you...
I would say it's more degrees of specificity.
Okay.
So identity is quite generic, right?
Yeah.
It's something that you can kind of hold on to as what you were given as your, you know, hey, this is who I am, right?
Yeah.
Then a purpose is taking that and, hey, this is what I want to do with that. And the mission and calling is, okay, this is what it looks like when I succeed. Okay,
cool.
All right, did you have a question?
I did. What if, like, in the Bible, and you keep saying happiness, which I love, but, like, I've heard different people speak about happiness and how God is, like, not about our happiness. Can you speak on that?
That's a good question.
So about our happiness?
That's what I've heard.
Oh, okay.
I don't believe that, but...
That's
you. Yeah.
I'll get to that in a later slide. Just put
okay.
A pin in that one. If I don't get to it, remind me. Unless you have...
No.
We'll
wait. It's...
Okay.
I was coming.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
I have a question to you just on, like, the purpose of the business. You ever... Yeah. The goal of the business to make money. Right. So, I mean, I think that comes with, like, intrinsic problems, obviously, with...
Well, who would ever start a business and not make money?
Mm-hmm.
Right, right. Well,
that's the whole point.
Just that, but if it doesn't, it's not sustainable. Why would you?
That's a good thing.
Right.
And that's something that we've seen that through our careers. We have, and we started a private equity, like calling it that, a holding company, and we've used these principles, and we're going to show the private equity world that you can do this a different way.
I like that. That's what I.
However, I was just going to say, like, the company I worked for was purchased by a very large global private equity, and they're clearly, the goal is to make money.
Yeah.
And my team just felt that over the course of, like, 3 months.
Yes.
Severely, so, appreciate it.
Right. So private equity is a charge for as well.
Oh,
yeah.
Again, 99%+ of them out there are after one thing, which is actually probably 100% of them are out there. One thing, which is money, right? So they'll charge management fees, they'll kind of bleed the company dry, they'll cut heads, make things look good, and then sell an empty shell later.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, there's the one that we worked for were the surge protectors he was talking about. It was one that we actually would work for. A lot of them, they would come to us and say, I don't care if you have to lay off everyone in the bill, I need to see this EBITDA in 2 years.
Right.
They didn't care.
No.
And I'm like, no thanks.
So that gets to the point that you originally made about the profit, right? The difference is this. Profit, again, maybe I've already demonized it too much. But the goal is this. Here, profit is a first order effect. Profit is the objective. Over here, profit is the side effect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Design well, your processes, your business, etc., should generate a profit, but you've got to do it the right way. And as a side effect, you make money, right? That's kind of how we want to model the system. And we'll show you how we kind of do practical applications of that. But good question. Keep that in mind in case I don't answer it. So.
Right. And I'll give you another insight. Our consulting business that we have for 30 years, we've never had a budget. We don't have budget meetings. We sit around and say, what's the right thing to do for the customer? And guess what happens? The money comes right along with it.
Matter of fact,
the money comes and we don't even need it.
That seems so obvious. Like, it does, but somehow people still get trapped into this.
Oh, it's easy to get sucked
in. Chasing the money. Like, I have to chase that.
Right. So to bring it down to...
I think it's
like,
fear.
Yeah, sorry, think about this.
I'm saying it's fear. Yeah. It's fear. You don't have the money, then the business goes under. Then, you know,
right.
These things that...
It's true.
Think about the metrics, right? Metrics drive behaviors, right? When we measure stuff, you measure your kids to drive their behavior, those kind of things. What is big business, public companies, what's their metrics?
Profit.
Yeah, it's Wall Street, right? I blame Wall Street.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a structure that, it's a kingdom structure, not a kingdom structure, but an empire structure, right? And they're measured by quarter. And if you notice, well, maybe you don't notice, I noticed because I coach a lot of them. They stay in a job 4 or 5 years, CEOs.
They don't. Yeah. I've read an article about that. Sorry. An article about that exact problem that business leaders have an extremely short horizon.
Yeah.
And they don't.
Why wouldn't you?
They get it right.
Yeah, why wouldn't you? So if I make all these, I get a bonus, right?
Yes.
I teach business ethics. So we have whole chapters on this, and I love it. But even in the context of us in here that are from Kingsport that know Eastman never had a layoff for 40, 60, 80 years. Then the driving force changed. And the reason is they are now answerable to Wall Street. They were not, I don't think they were, and that's what I want to ask you. How did we change from being answerable to Wall Street to being answerable to our community and to our employees? And that's definitely a change because everything's driven by quarters and annual.
Absolutely.
When did that happen? How did that happen? Is it just greed-based?
Greed. Nothing but greed.
And Jeff hit the nail on the head earlier. I'm sure you all recognize this as well. How you're measured is going to affect how you behave, right?
Yeah.
Right metrics will affect behavior a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
The right incentives will as well, and the wrong incentives will give you the wrong behavior as well. You can hack a metric. It's a formula. You can hack it. You can find a way to change the denominator or numerator and game it somehow such that your bonus looks better, right? How many of you guys work for corporations or companies where at the end of the month you do stupid things?
Did you raise your hand?
Yeah.
Okay.
But you do, like at the end of the month you do things. You'll pull revenue forward from the next month just to inflate your monthly revenue, especially at the quarter and the end of the year.
Yeah.
What does that do for the customer? Nothing. But how much overtime and heartache and stress does it create on the employees?
Right.
You're serving the wrong audience in that situation. Mm-hmm. Not you guys, but in general, people are serving the wrong audience when that happens, right? So one way that we can avoid the situation is by aligning metrics. And by aligning metrics and incentives, we're trying to find win-win situations. Okay, cliche, right? Win-win. But we're also trying to find lose-lose situations. We want the metrics to be aligned such that we either win together or we lose together. Because then there's no divergence when the decision has to be made, right? How many of you have been in a board meeting where someone stands up and is like, hey, my responsibility is my shareholders. I don't care about you guys and my investors, right? But I need to make money for my investors. To heck with the rest of this. That is obviously misaligned incentives. Someone was in a different class of shareholding or had a different tranche or whatever it was, and they can benefit from everyone else's suffering, right? So I prefer the model where, kind of like Hernan Cortez when they came on the shores of South America and they burned the boats, hey, you don't even think about going back there. We're either gonna make it or we're gonna die, right? I mean, it shouldn't be that serious. But the bottom line is, if you can win together or lose together and walk away from the situation saying, hey, gave it a great shot, just didn't work out, that's success.
So we've got to change it. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to change it.
Yeah,
God's given this commission.
A practical example is this. We invested in a company in Houston, and it was led by a Fortune 500 company, And in there, the terms of that class is shared, there was a put option. Do you guys know what that means? It means you can take your owning your holdings and put it back on the company for a certain amount. Okay? That protects downside for the investor. And we said, we're not going to invest unless they take away the put. Because in that situation, sure, we'll benefit as well. But then we're not interested in the company's success. Mm-hmm. We're only interested in a certain number. And if you try and treat business like a math problem, the outcome is just going to be obvious every single time. And we don't need to do that. So that's how we align incentives.
And one of the quotes I just felt like it was important to share, the quote that says, we repeat what we celebrate. Mm. And as a culture, so we're talking big picture, a lot of us aren't CEOs, boards, and whatnot, but maybe we have small businesses. And I would ask you to ask the question, what are you celebrating with your team? Mm-hmm. Because you're putting out the firm, that's what we're going to repeat. So what did Wall Street do? They celebrated earnings reports and quarterly. So guess what everybody said? Let's get in line for that. And so if you think about that, churches do the same thing. What do we celebrate? Oh, we should ask that. Because that's what your people are going to produce, right?
Yeah. Right?
And so it's a good thought to have that kind of brings it down, I think, to a little bit
more. Yeah, it's a really good point. And you think about it as well, in the companies that you've worked for in the past, how many of you guys remember the core values? Or did you have core values? Mm-hmm. Now, consider the people that got promoted in those companies. Mm-hmm. Is there an alignment or a mismatch, right? So think about what the company really values versus what they say they value. Yeah.
Do you think that the counter to that is things like, you know, the top companies to work for? You know, is that something that's trying to flip to the other side of looking not just at profits, but like, oh, this is the best company to work for, this is what employees say?
I have a Jeff theory on that. I'll share it if you don't mind. But there was a time, and they still do it, like they have this healthcare program in this company. They build a gym, they have all the stuff, their daycare. Oh, they really care about the people. I've been in those board meetings. They don't care about the people. It's because they can lower their insurance rates.
Yeah.
That's the only reason they did it.
Yeah.
And yet, you know why they did daycare?
Keep them so working.
Yeah. So they can work overtime. Oh, the kids, oh yeah, we'll watch the kids, so whatever. Yeah. They had nothing to do with it. So it's kind of like buying organic. Everything's organic now, right? And you know it's BS, right? It's not organic, right? They, just a week before, they were growing corn that they sprayed all their chemicals on, and all of a sudden it's organic. It's still in the soil, right? So I think some of them, and I hate to talk ill of people or other companies, but I'm sure maybe the initial intent was, hey, let's do something nice, and then it just turned into, hey, how can we profit all this? A good example, and I'll shut up here. Good example is our gas prices okay? What are they blaming on?
Tax wars.
The war, Ukraine war. Where do you think we get most of our oil in the United States? Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So explain to me why we're paying more. But anyway, sorry.
That's a good insight. All right, excellent. So enduring works are created by people motivated by passion. So think about the most enduring works in history. Some examples are like the Duomo in Milan. Have you guys ever seen like beautiful old ancient cathedrals or the Sistine Chapel, like the, you know, the paintings on top, etc.? If I had $1 billion, I couldn't remake any of those things. Because the people that worked on those projects didn't do it for money, even though they were financed by, you know, people like the Medici's, but they did it because they felt a calling to do it. They felt that mission, that passion. They were working their identity to create something beautiful, the Taj Mahal, etc., stuff like that, right? And so imagine if you had a company with people aligned to their mission, working to kind of, you know, as a team to achieve that mission. That would be pretty incredible.
Yeah, you know, I just thought of a good example. We did coaching with the CEO, and it was about, hey, help us with the vision, right? So, of course, the first question we asked, well, what's the vision? Well, let me show you. Go out and it's on the wall, right? You know, save a whale, hug a tree, kind of thing, right? So, of course, I skipped their staff and just go on down and talk to all the other people in the organization. Of course, no one knew what the vision was, what they needed to do. So we went back and we explained to them, you know, this isn't working, so what is it that you want? And she, and I can't remember exactly, but she boiled down to, I want delighted customers, I want happy employees, and I want to make a profit. That's all I want to do. I said, well, that's easy. So we took that down all the way to the level. So now the work, the people that actually make the money, right, the people that are in the organization to make the money, only had three things they need to worry about. Are we delighting the customer? Are we creating a happy workplace? And are we still making money yet? Right? And our consulting would help them do that, because we look at processes and try to eliminate waste, and we use them, the people that made the money, to make that happen.
So one of the points regarding the lists of best places to work, Wendy, In this situation, what we don't want to happen is a self-feeding system where, hey, you're ranked at top, you're gonna get the best people. The people that really need the help aren't the ones at the top of that list. They're the ones farther down. And in many cases, we're not gonna be working for those organizations top anyway. So where we can have influence, where we can make transformation is within our area of influence. Take some of these principles and they work. And infuse it where you are and let that, you know, kind of like expand outward. Let that influence expand outward. That example, that beacon on the hill, right? Let that expand outward, through example. All right, great. Driving forces again. So this is just a dichotomy between empire and kingdom and what they're called in each realm. So in the empire, you have titles. Your identity is attached to the title. I'm a CEO, I'm a blah, blah, CFO, whatever. In the kingdom, I have an identity, right? That's what I am, that's my true identity. In the empire, you have a career. In the kingdom, you have a purpose. In the empire, you have comfort. In the kingdom, you have tranquility. Can somebody explain the difference between comfort and tranquility, or why someone should pursue tranquility over comfort? Yeah, anyone?
I was going to say, like, peace, you have peace, you have tranquility, comfort is just
the way I look at it is like comfort is like I might have a really plush mattress, but tranquility is that
sleep.
Yeah. I can sleep really well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah, so both answers are absolutely correct. I mean, you don't necessarily have to be comfortable to be at peace either, to be tranquil, right? Like Nelson Mandela, for example, or I mean
Paul.
Yeah.
Paul, he spent most of his time in prison, right?
But I can't use his identity, and so I'm sure he's at peace with the situation. Right? Pleasure versus joy. Same similar fine line between the two, right? One is more short-term, one is something you can buy almost, but joy, that comes from really operating your identity, right? Doing what you feel like you're meant to do. That's how you know you're operating in the right identity, right?
Is that a metric?
You feel that joy.
Is that a metric?
It's an unmeasurable, but you'll feel it.
Yeah. If you have a healthy workplace, you say you've got some of you guys a business owner, if you have a healthy workplace,
it's awesome.
For sure.
Right? I mean, We've done some of the consulting that we do, and we'll have phone calls, emails, letters, whatever. People will say, I don't know what you've done, but my husband and my wife loves going to work now. Mm-hmm. Right? They were part of it, right? Mm-hmm. So that's where that joy, that's a good measure.
Talk about this, rewards and resources, and measurables and measurables.
The other thing is the left side is conditional, and the right side is more unconditional.
That's right. Yeah.
There you go. Like love,
and,
right?
Yeah. There's really nothing more insidious than someone trying to blur the lines between the two. They're going to try to pretend, hey, we're going to help you operate your identity, and they're really giving you that proxy for all these things over here. And they may not do it intentionally, because that's what they grew up with as well, right? That's the system they were in as well. So this can happen, and none of these things are wrong, but this is what is, you know, true and authentic, right?
We actually go to the extreme. We'll go into a company and we'll do like the identities of the people in it, because again, the company isn't a company, it's not a building, right? It's the people inside of it. And then we say, okay, but now that we've got the identities of what's going on inside, what's the identity of your company? They're like, well, you know, we make pencils. Well, that's not going to change, you're still making pencils. What's the identity of your company? And it makes you think, and then it all gives them a chance to community, right? And as we'll go through and talk about, you need each other to make this new process work that we're trying to share, working in the kingdom.
I wonder too if creativity is really lost, you know.
Oh, it's absolutely lost.
Because you're just, you know, you're just trying to make the buck, and then but all that the kingdom side. I mean, it creativity mystery is like thrives.
Yeah, you're preempting the presentation. So. Mystery, in opposition to certainty, right? And there's such this obsession with experts, people that know the answers, that are certain this is going to work. And what we need to get to is a point of connection where it's okay to take risks, to be creative, to put yourself out there, right? And without the fear of being judged. So mentality-wise, I'm sure you've seen something similar to this from Jamie and other people. Separation implies scarcity, right? It's self-promoting. Here, I'm going to protect myself, I need that promotion, etc. I'm going to take credit for something that I didn't do. And you have certainty as well, which sounds kind of counterintuitive or difficult to kind of wrap your head around, because certainty, wait, why should we consider something in separation? It's because when you're certain about something, you're not open to other ideas so much, right? Profit-driven, and again, not to demonize too much, but this shouldn't be the pursuit. It should be the side effect, like I mentioned earlier, right? And in the separation mindset in the empire, you're accountable to authority. You're accountable to someone because you're driven to avoid punishment, not to pursue greatness, right? How many people work in an environment where you're conditioned to just do what you're told, because if you do anything extra and you screw up, you get in trouble for that. I mean, we don't want an environment like that. That doesn't create greatness. You know, it creates minions. That's what we want. In connection, you have abundance, right? And there is abundance. There's plenty to go around. Look at the private equities, for example, that buy these companies, and they take all this money out. That money could have gone to do other things to help enrich the people that are actually doing the work. There's codependence. So this is a difficult one to grasp as well, because all of us grow up with this idea of independence, self-sufficiency. I mean, I struggle with this as well. It's hard for me to ask for help. But in a state of connection, you realize that, sure, you're enough on your own, but you can do so much more as a group with other identities, right? Instead of certainty, you have courage, which means it's okay to take risks. And one thing I like to say is confidence isn't thinking you can't fail. That's certainty, right? Confidence is being unafraid to fail, right? So going out and actually doing it and being okay with the idea of failing. Being mission-driven versus profit-driven, as a side effect, profit comes around. And at the end, you're accountable to the team and the mission. Hey, I want this to work because I want everyone to succeed. I want the mission to be successful. That's the mentality. Yeah.
There's one that came to mind about abundance. We did some work for Toyota in San Antonio where they make the pickup truck. And we were there one day, and I was noticing these guys walking around. They had Ford and General Motors on their T-shirts or their shirts or whatever. I'm like, you know those guys are in here. They're like, oh, yeah, we always give tours of those guys. We don't care. I said, so you don't care that they're here? Mm-hmm. He goes, it doesn't matter. He says, by the time they get back to where they're going to try to explain what they do, we'll be, you know, 10 years ahead of them anyway. So it doesn't really matter. So we like to share and share with our community. Think about that. Sharing with your
competitors.
Would you do that?
No way.
And they do it, and they don't care. And look, Toyota's still successful. Seem like Ford and those guys struggle, but they're still pretty successful.
You're not in the world of self-preservation and scarcity, right? You're hiding, you're protecting all that stuff. And one thing that Jeff and I would say when we talk to companies that tout their IP and the protections there, IP is not a durable competitive advantage. Eventually someone's going to find a way around it, eventually become open source or whatever it is. The bottom line is we should be so confident or so courageous that we can give our processes, our IP to somebody else, and we're still going to do it better than you. That's how we should build our companies, right? To have that courage.
And if you think of it this way, you all have an identity, and it doesn't matter if they steal your idea, you're going to deliver totally different than what they are. So it doesn't matter. We used to have a conversation all the time about there's a lot of consultants, right? Well, we need to change, we need to look like, well, nobody can deliver like they can, so it doesn't really matter. Because, I mean, you can go online and see all the stuff we do. You can get downloaded. But good luck.
And quite honestly, we'd be happy if someone took these ideas and put them out into the business world, right? If we were able to at least show someone like a pathway to get toward a kingdom model and it were replicated, that's success to us. Again, we don't need it to be visible or celebrated. We just want it to happen, right? That's how important the mission is.
I have a comment on that, Leon.
Yes.
I think right now, I'm in market research and marketing, and with AI and the advances that AI are making, I use AI all the time because I work across a million different companies and we're turning out proposals so quickly. And it's like, you can get on AI and you can load in an RFP and be like, okay, the company wants to understand blah, 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 this is the approach I'm gonna take, et cetera, et cetera. And they can spit out, I mean, so much information. So there really, really is that information so accessible, but the way that you deliver it and package it and lead, that's what the AI can't do.
Yeah.
And
so
they'll
I
never
think,
do.
They will never be able to do it. And so as I was looking at your last slide, I was thinking it's so important for us as leaders, and especially like, you know, mid to high level leaders, to model that behavior up and down. Because if we want the teams that report up to us to have more work-life balance and all these things, but we're afraid of our leadership or we're afraid of the CEO, and so we're going to do a report for them on a Saturday or we're going to pull something together overtime, or we're going to send out emails to our team after hours. Like, all of that stuff is modeling this terrible behavior, and it drives fear. And so part of it is like to delegate, to be vulnerable, to say no, to prioritize our families. Like, it's so easy to say all this to the people below us, but to still like you know, manage up for our bonus or our thing. Or our, and it's, so it's like that, if we have to be vulnerable and model that,
right,
if we really want it to pervade.
Absolutely.
Know?
I mean, that's
right,
that's good. You're really nailing the point about the audience, right? Who
yes,
are you getting all this for, right?
Right.
Yeah, look at Jonathan. Jonathan's
yes,
story, right?
Yeah.
Think right, about that.
Yeah.
He totally bought, and now he's got more time to make
yeah,
the answer.
Yeah.
If I could just make another comment following on that, what I hear you saying is that if you function without knowing your identity, then you move what you provide to simply a commodity,
yeah,
which is which you perceive to be identical rather than a service, which is differentiated by your personality.
That's
and
a good
your
way of putting
identity. Identity.
That's actually a really good way of putting it. So, like, you think about it, people go to college, they come out with a degree, and you're a clone.
Yeah.
Everybody else that graduated with you with the same band of grade, whatever it was, right?
Yeah.
What really separates you is those things that aren't on your resume, that you didn't go to school to take these classes. It's your interest in rock climbing or off-roading, whatever it is. That's the kind of stuff that really differentiates you, and that's that personality that you can add to it. You're right, people are going to see AI, things like that, as a threat, but there's a way to adapt with it,
yeah,
right? And to kind of enhance what you're doing and to, you know, elevate your skill set as well. So, very good points. You mentioned Jonathan's speech earlier. My main takeaway from that was that I'm glad that he was, like, had some doubt and he still got what he wanted. It means that pure faith is not a condition of getting the blessing.
Yeah.
Because I struggle with that all the time. So I'm like, well, is it going to happen or not? And I'm just glad that I don't have to be 100% committed for the blessing to arrive. So. Excellent. Good questions, guys. All right. Now, how is abundance modeled in the kingdom? Now, this is where we get to how we're actually running our business. Okay. And this is a bit of an eye chart, but I'll try and walk you guys through it. Let me explain entities first. So you have a holding company or some corporate office or whatever it is, and you have a sub-entity, which could be a business unit, it could be a subsidiary, it could be a company that you purchased or whatever it is. Let's start at subsidiary level. So let's say you have, let's say you have a company, sorry, and you have clients bring in revenue, clearly, so this is your revenue, right? The portion of revenue that goes to pay OPEX, that's obvious. You pay for salaries, for your rents, for materials, whatever it is. And then you have something left over. You have the profit, okay? And of that EBITDA, that profit, 20% of the gross goes to pay for gratitude. Not pay, but it's provided as gratitude to the entity that supported you. So the first people that are taken care of here are the ones doing the work, right? The ones doing the work and the ones providing for the workers. The second tranche, so that 20% of gross, it goes to those that you need to show gratitude to, for. So this used to be called dividends or whatever it is, but in our model, at least, we want to consider it gratitude, right? So, hey, thanks for investing in us, thanks for believing in us. This is your, you know, this is the gratitude that we're going to show you. Now, anything on top of that is then split 50-50 with the people that we show gratitude to and the team. That way, there's unlimited, uncapped upside for the team that does the work. We can share along with that benefit there as well. So that's kind of how this model works. Am I making sense so far? I know this is a lot,
mm-hmm,
and a lot of numbers, and it's late in the day and I'm making you do math, but do you get this? All right,
yeah.
Great, so this is kind of how that works. And the cool thing about it, the elegant thing, is that that also works the next level up, and the next level up, and the next level up. So this portion that goes up to the holding company or the corporate area, goes to pay OPEX, obviously, okay? And then 20% of the gross is given out as gratitude. Again, it could be interests or dividends or whatever. And then the remainder is split somehow, okay? It can go to pay the team, or it can be used as reserve capital to further fuel growth, right? So now you're investing in the company, you're enriching the employees, enriching the investors, and the people that are doing the work are being rewarded along the way. This is our abundance model, and this is actually the one that we're using. Now, just some fine details on this. Formulaically, this can all be calculated rather easily, right? But the amount of gratitude that comes back, the profit share that comes back to the team, that might be structured differently depending upon the kind of work you're doing. But the bottom line is there is a reserve that goes back to the team to demonstrate, you know, to reward them for the work they've done. How does this influence? Yes, go on.
So the problem when you're presenting this to somebody is, I've never shared the profits, and now you're telling me to share the profits, right?
I am, yeah.
So how do you, I mean, isn't this ultimately take a significant change of heart to move from self-promoting?
Yes, the very last slide, we'll talk about who's threatened by this model.
Yeah. Think about this, we don't need a CEO anymore. You think the CEO likes to hear that?
I'll get to that, but he's, yeah, both of you guys are preempting the end, which is awesome. But yeah, a lot of people are threatened by this model. And what I would tell the company that doesn't want to be profit sharing is, here, either do this now or you're going to lose to us later. So it's a cycle that I believe creates a better outcome for a company. Right?
We actually believe in our hearts that we're not going to have to go out and look for businesses to buy. They're going to come to us. Mm-hmm. And say, hey, we want to be part of it. We've already had people do this. Say, hey, I want to be part of it.
We want you to buy so that we can function in this
way. We were visiting with the CPA of a company that we're buying, the CPA, and of course, she knows what's going on. And she said, oh, I want to be part of it. How can I be part of it? It's just like, that's what we want. Because everyone, it's an abundance.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've actually got a lot of detail behind this. I'm just pulling out some of the generic top-level stuff. But just specifically on this situation, if you think about in any transaction or any kind of a system, there's more than four, but I'm going to categorize them four. You have the managers of the system, you have the investors, you have the employees, and you have the fourth one.
Craftsman. I'm not sure where you're going.
Just bear with me a second here. Gotta.
While you're doing that, we also have he's a friend too, but a huge investor in Houston. We've done a lot of work with him, and he's great. He's a great guy. He's a mentor almost to both of us. We showed him this concept. I've never seen him so excited in my life. It's like, we got to get this in front of these people.
Right.
Yeah. And again, it's a God thing. It's not.
It's all like family offices that you're talking to.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, obviously, most people aren't interested in that. So you're talking about certain family offices.
Well, this individual is actually in the private equity world. He's like a billionaire. He was one of the founders of Denham Capital. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's a really large private equity that was based in Houston. And he's one who's kind of advising us on some of this stuff as well. But he's super interested in this model as well. The fourth entity, by the way, is the founder. And I forgot that one. The reason I'm bringing that up is because, as Jeff mentioned, the founders want to participate in this. And our first commitment to them is that we will honor your brand promise and your legacy. So we're not going to change your name. We're not going to change the way you operate. We're not going to change what you mean to the marketplace. So when someone asks me the question, hey, when they hear your name in the marketplace, what do you want that to mean? We're going to preserve that, you know, that brand promise. Anyway, sorry, just a bit of a sidebar.
Is this slide deck? I heard somebody might say we're going to pass that out.
Yeah, you guys can have this.
Unless everybody knows that helps when you're taking notes. So.
Yeah, it's totally cool. Yeah. I'll distribute this to anybody who wants it.
Cool.
So, okay. Did I answer?
Profit.
I think 20%.
All right, so do you guys understand the abundance model? Mm-hmm. Okay, I know there's questions that are outstanding, and I'll get to those. And, how does an organization function in the kingdom? Now, this is another interesting paradigm. I know you guys can't read that. I'll explain it to you. But a typical organization is structured like a hierarchy, right? An hierarchy. So you have top-down, command and control, executives, management, directors, etc., and they all go down to the bottom level, which is the workforce, right? And it's a very fragile system because there are many single points of failure. Imagine in some of these corporations you work for, are there any key individuals that if they got hired by a competitor, you'd be scared to death?
Mm-hmm, sure.
That's a fragile system, right? And we don't want that. We don't want single points of failure, but in an hierarchy, you have that. And therefore, how do you keep them incentivized? Pay them more, give them more, because they're good at what? I guess telling people below them what to do, right? Imbalances in compensation. And this is a huge one, right? As you ascend that hierarchy, you get paid a heck of a lot more than the people below you got paid. Mm-hmm. But who's actually doing the work? People on the very bottom floor. So, like, we work for a company in North Carolina that made furniture, right? It's very obvious how you can take $40 worth of materials, fabric, cushions, wood, and put a person on it, and an hour later you got a sofa that's worth $4,000. It's obvious how that person adds value to the process. They change their form, fit, and function of those materials that were worth this much, and now they've created something worth that much. They've added that much value. Go up the chain. How are they adding value? How are they doing anything the customer is willing to pay them to do? It's hard to tell, right? But they still get paid more because they're managing people below them, right? So that's the issue with imbalances in competition. That creates resentment. It creates systems where you're like, oh man, I'm doing all this work, I'm making them rich, etc. Inverse value add and authority relationship, we kind of talked about that. Actual value add rapidly diminishes while you ascend the hierarchy. Misaligned incentives, so there's silos. I'm sure you've heard this in work as well. You have that competition between manufacturing and quality sometimes. Quality wants to hold everything back, manufacturing wants to shove everything out the door. You got the sales department that wants to dream up new SKUs with new whatever's on them, and then manufacturing has to accommodate that. So there's misaligned incentives. Purchasing wants to buy the cheaper stuff, and because of purchase price variance, and that doesn't work for their customer, who's the manufacturing person, right? Innovation stifling and slow adaptability. This goes to the creativity thing that we talked about earlier, right? It stifles creativity in that, look, no one wants to raise any kind of new ideas because they're just sitting there taking orders, right? They get punished almost for bringing up new ideas. And talent retention morale is pretty low in a situation like that. I'm really describing this in a bad way, but can you see echoes of this at least in
corporate
empire world, right?
Yes, but misaligned incentives. My company, they say, oh, that's the tension between like judicial and executive branch, and we make sure that like challenges everybody
to
perform better.
Very good. So you heard the balanced scorecard?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. So there's still a dynamic and a strain between the two. Hey guys, we're on the same team. That's what we try to tell people all the time. And sure, one person can make their metric look really good in the hopes that some other metric's going to balance that out. But the bottom line is someone can benefit from someone else's pain within the organization. That shouldn't happen, right? Because then you have misaligned incentives. How does the procurement guy make his bonus typically? Purchase price variance. This is my budget for wood or whatever it was. It costs, you know, 10 bucks or whatever. I got it for 8 bucks. Hey, I've saved the company that much money. And any consultant can tell you, saving money on the cost side is worth 5 times as much on the sales side, right? Because of the margin, etc. And so they look like heroes. But then what happens when that wood doesn't work on manufacturing? You just spent 20 times more to try and manufacture something. You got all this scrap, you got all this other stuff that doesn't go out the door, your reputation suffers and all stuff. Hey, but they got their bonus, right? So I understand the balanced scorecard, and if it's well designed, it works pretty well, right? But when it's not well designed, and I think 90% of the companies out there don't do it well, you end up with this dynamic, right? So, does that make sense?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that was satisfactory, but that's... I'll show you a better way, if that might make things better. Okay. All right, so introduce you to a new word called the holarchy, and this is a real word. It was coined by some science fiction author. I can't remember his name again. Anyway, it's based upon the idea of what's called a holon, which is a unit that is adequate and enough on its own, but the holarchy is when you get all these holons together and you create a system that is greater than some of those parts, a gestalt of some sort, right? So we envision four roles in an organization. I'll show you that later as well. But with a holarchy, what you have is you have teams. You don't have a command and control structure. You have people that have a mission, they know what they're there to do, the good work, and they perform in their task, in their identity, and the end result is mission success, okay? Mm-hmm. That's how a holarchy works. So you have, we want resilience in the organization, so you have, you know, people doing similar tasks, and they can float around. Fair compensation, so everyone is compensated for what they do in a way that makes sense economically for the company. Let me expand on that a little bit, because there were a lot of questions about that in the earlier session. If you look at entire companies, right, there's typically interrelated links in the value chain in that company, okay? Let me give you an example. So we're looking at buying a property management company, and there are certain business units in that company. One of them is door recruitment. They go out there and they try and find new homeowners to put under the portfolio, okay? So their job is one thing. They go out there and recruit doors. It's very easy to define them as a business. Their income is based upon the commission they get when they place a door with leasing department, et cetera. And so they have a revenue stream. Now, the next link in the value chain is leasing. You've got this empty door, you brought to the leasing department. Their metric is making sure they can put people in those units, right? And their revenue is 80% of the first month's rent. So they have revenue now. So every link in the value chain is considered a profit center, right? A typical organization may look at that and say, hey, look, as a company, I'm making this much money, this is a cost center, but supporting this revenue, whatever it is, We want every single piece to be its own business, its own profit center. And that does a few things. First, it keeps you honest in terms of competition with the market. If you can't do it better than someone else out there, you can't get cheaper, maybe you should be going somewhere else to get the service, right? But we believe everything you do in your company should be done so well that someone should be willing to pay you to do it. That's how well we should run our organizations, right? So each business unit can be designed as a profit center. And what's important is the customer, and sorry, the supplier and customer relationships in each link of the value chain. Am I making sense? Because I'm talking a lot about org theory, so.
Kind of just got a question, like, can they be both property and a cost center? Can they share, have their own P&L so that you can see whether they're...
Yeah, each one should be a profit center of some sort.
Okay.
So even a service that's considered a support organization,
yeah.
If you went external for that, how much would you pay for that service, right? So
right.
Accounting, for example, if you had an external CPA doing your books, how much would you pay for that service? Now, bringing that in-house, you can charge that expense from the accounting department to the rest of the organization, maybe spread out in some way or other,
right?
And that way you can still consider a profit center. I don't recommend doing it, at least with small companies, at that scale, because it gets really complicated and administrative. But at least on the obvious parts of the value chain, it's relatively easy to do that. Okay? Does that kind of make sense?
I think so. You like distribute shared service costs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, there's another advantage. Let's say the accounting department's really good at doing accounting, and they could sell that service to someone else.
Sure.
So you know, so you make it available so they can.
Yeah.
And that's what we try. You want them to be the best at what they do, so other people want to. Serve.
Well, particularly if they're in a specific industry. Become experts in the industry that they can then sell to.
Right. So the other thing is identity purpose career coherence. We talked about how we want to place people in these roles, in these pods, in these teams, according to their identities, right? What they love doing. Aligned incentives. This goes to your statement earlier, Wendy, about the balance scorecard and kind of checks and balances. Leasing as customer is property management. So once leasing is done, filling the door, filling a home with a tenant, that then goes into the property manager's portfolio to manage, right? The way that you balance that out, because you can game it, you can just throw anybody in there that's not going to pay their rent, and you can make sure that the unit's not in good condition. The way we balance that is, as a customer, you have certain quality specifications that you require, and in the first 30 days, if there's any maintenance issue, that gets charged back to leasing, to that company. And so there you have the incentive to make sure that whatever's passed to the next guy meets the quality specifications. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's ways you can balance that out. And again, it's not going to be so elegant in other companies or other kind of situations, but at least in this situation, try to create that feedback mechanism such that an ill perpetrated by the previous step in the value chain kind of falls back on them.
You're highlighting the importance of figuring out your metrics well, because you will get whatever you measure, and most metrics are designed very short-sightedly.
Yeah, so there's a lot of effort required in crafting this whole system. This is the theory, okay, I'll admit. It's a very generic, almost ambiguous level, but I think you can kind of see how this might filter down into the specific, right? The cool thing about it is this. Like I mentioned before, we're not the experts. We only bring the process. That doesn't mean this isn't our responsibility. It means we guide people through this process, facilitate, and we work with the teams doing the work to design this. So the outcome is still what they're after, right? But we don't have to be the ones to tell them what to do. Okay. All right. So flexible, agile organizations, and hopefully you have better talent retention and morale. So is this just kind of too?
It's good.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to get to in this model. Value, links in the value chain, right? So you kind of understand that. You have teams within these business units or value links, and they're all doing certain things, and interrelated, they're suppliers and customers, et cetera. Why do you need a CEO? Why would you need a CEO when each of these links can function as a profit center on their own? That's a huge cost savings already. But that doesn't mean that the role is not important. There's still something that you provide, and that's vision. Your strategy,
right?
The
right ones.
Yes. The right ones, right.
It's like lost opportunity costs too. It's so expensive, and also the wrong person who's operating with an empire mindset is investing in the wrong acquisitions and costing the company so much money and creating so much dissension, and then there's, I mean, it's just so so problematic, the wrong person.
It's true. And there are some situations where a person's a great CEO for a while, and then at a certain scale, they become the bottleneck. So there's something called the founder's dilemma. Have you guys heard of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Basically, the founders can't let go because they can't trust anyone to do anything as well as they can do it or care enough about what they're doing.
Yeah, I think.
You're familiar with that, Eric?
Yeah, I think the three of us talked about that.
Yeah, right. So this is a difficult one, right? Because it's hard to let go, and because of that, they become the bottleneck, and it's hard to scale out. Right?
Yeah.
So that requires trust in people. It requires the willingness to allow mistakes to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So they can learn and so they can get better. But as a system, as a whole, you have a much healthier company. Right? It's hard, but there's some medicine. All right. Let me go to the roles. These are not identities. These are roles that happen or that can take place when any effort is made. So we talk about the enduring works in history again, right? Let's just take the Duomo Milan, for example. If you've ever seen it, it's amazing. I think I mentioned this. But the carvings, you can see the veins in the people. And the marble statues on the outside. It's absolutely incredible. But some visionary had that vision. Hey, I want this to happen. Okay? And then some strategists took that vision and turned it into a work plan of some sort. Okay, we're going to need this, we need that, we need this, blah, blah, blah. Then you have mentors and facilitators, people that go in there and they execute that work plan. And then you have the craftsmen, the ones actually doing the work. Right? So in every situation, you have these roles. They're not necessarily dictated, not necessarily official. But these happen in those situations. Think about high school or middle school when you guys had a skit to do for English class or whatever it was. You got together with a bunch of friends, you had a vision, you had a great time. No one said, hey, I'm the CEO, I'm gonna tell you guys what to do. You guys just brainstormed and just had a great time doing it and ended up with an awesome product, right? Do you remember this? So this is kind of the roles that happen in a holarchy. So you might have a title. You might have roles, responsibilities that you're required to do, but when something needs to happen, that's when you get these roles together. You get people together, and you have to have these roles in them. Again, not designated, but they happen unofficially, and that's how you get progress.
Mm. So. And just for a little insight, because a lot of this is new, it sounds new, but has any of you heard of a Kaizen?
Mm-hmm.
Kaizen event, right? What a Kaizen does, it takes people from different disciplines. You have a problem. Take people from different disciplines, and you solve the problem. And that's all it is. You're moving something through. So whatever product or service that they make, they get together like a Kaizen with these four headings there, and they move the product through, the service through, as opposed to somebody with a clipboard, hey, you gotta do this, you gotta do that. And someone mentioned creativity, I put you on the front row there. This will foster creativity, especially when you're in your identity.
Maybe I should start with the Kaizen idea because, quite frankly, the reason we decided to do this at the company level is because we've been doing this at the micro scale quite frequently in departments and teams, et cetera, and companies where we have this kind of strategy. We go into a Kaizen event and we don't have titles anymore. We have a problem, we have people with talents. Now let's facilitate them all toward a solution. And it works so well. Yes, sir.
So this is fluid rather than rigid.
It is fluid, right. You're not always the visionary. You're not always the craftsman.
I mean, if you're the visionary one time, you may not be the next problem, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But you don't have to designate that. You'll know.
Yeah.
You'll
okay.
feel it. You'll know where you can kind of fit in this kind of a structure. But this is kind of how progress is made, right? You have visionaries, strategists, because oftentimes a visionary can't communicate what they're doing to a level that people can execute it. That's why you need strategists to build the roadmap. And you got a mentor and facilitator guide, and finally you got the craftsmen that are actually doing the work. So
this is why you don't need a CEO. And with if you use the Kaizen concept, which is really what this is, they'll notice it. The traditional hierarchy job, you don't need it. So a good example is a property management company we're looking at. The CEO was like, I remember we were in a meeting. She said, "Oh, I gotta get these finances. What I gotta do? You don't have to do anything anymore. What is it that you like to do?" Leon asked the great questions. What is it that I like to do? She likes to business development. So guess what? That's your job now. You're a business developer. We'll run the company. Well, not we. Your people will run the company, and you go get more money. And which is really what she wanted to do all along, but she couldn't do it because she's answering the phone. The toadstool is leaking or whatever. Because they're all doing all this chaotic stuff because they think that they need to do all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. So think about your responsibilities and your careers, why you got into those jobs in the first place, what gives you energy, what you love, and think about all the stuff that happens on the day that pulls you away from the stuff you love doing. right? We want people in the roles where they're going to perform, because it's like the CEO. We don't pay her to sit there and like do finances. We pay her to go out there and try and develop more work. That's what she's best at, right? So ACE is in the places. That's what we want to.
And everyone said this is the first time they've seen her smile in like 5-7 years.
But old habits are hard to break. She's still in the weeds.
Oh,
quite often. You've got to pull her out all the time because she's so used to going in there and checking everyone's work and stressing about this and that. And as much as she hates it, there's some gratification I think she gets out of it. And we've got to find a way to break that.
Yeah.
It's that command, that control, that power that I think she's unwilling to let go of. But we're working through that.
Yeah.
So,
we need to move her office out of the
building.
And what's interesting, because you mentioned earlier, is it gets rid of like the kind of the short term like burnout and creates longevity for a CEO. Because instead of like, I've got 3 years to do crazy things and hopefully it works out. If not, I'm just leaving it and walking away.
Absolutely.
So it's that idea of like, that person can also step into their identity more and actually have a career with the company and grow versus just like in and out.
That's correct, yeah. Especially if they're in their identity, right? They're going to love doing it. They're not going to feel like it when you retire because it's what they do, right? There's no longer work-life balance. It's like, hey, I'm just going to do what I love doing. And that's going to result in this.
We did some work for company in Idaho.
Yeah, Coeur d'Alene.
Another place. It doesn't matter. And the CEO, we went into his office and he had all these business books. I mean, all of them.
No, that was Ben Dorman.
And good memory. And he's like, all these books. And he's like, you know, we're trying to get him to not think that way, right? He got his identity because he thought he was a CEO. And that wasn't who he was. He was, you know, he was a person.
Right? He read every book.
Right, and but he was trying to be the CEO. And quite frankly, the job that he should have never been in that job. And how many times have we seen that, right?
Yes.
Hundreds of times, right? He actually, and we weren't there, but he actually had a staff meeting. One of their guys told me, and the CFO had a responsibility to deliver something to the meeting, and he didn't do it. He told the guy to get down and give me 20. These are grown men and women, right? I'm like, what? But it's probably one of those books up there probably said that's what you need to do, public humiliation, right? To get people to do the job.
But you see those people like quoting all the right things,
mm-hmm.
right? And then they're acquired or something and they're put into the role to like bring the new company on, and the new company's like, what were you ever doing? Like, you can say all the right things, but you have no
mm-hmm.
idea what's happening in the company.
Right. But who does? People in the company.
Exactly. The person
right
cleaning the floor.
That's right.
Yeah, unbelievable.
Exactly.
And even fiscally, too, like, because their salaries are so high, and severances, because it's such a short term, and the gaps between the gigs and stuff, too, can also be minimized if there's more longevity and, like, hey, I'm okay taking this knowing I'm happy and I'm going to be here for 10 years versus that gap of, like, I don't know if I'm ever going to get the next CEO gig.
Yeah.
So there's a learning curve, especially, like, with, you know, any kind of employee, you bring them in, there's going to be some time where they have to get their arms around the situation, and then there's that learning curve, your training, et cetera. And if they don't last, then shoot. I mean, just waste all the time, right? It's HR's dilemma, right? We're trying to people all the time, and there's no productivity. So these are all really good points. Regarding the hierarchy, so one thing I failed to mention was this. The new model isn't top-down hierarchical. It's inverted.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that works is you have the craftsmen doing the work, and the people that were originally managing them are now supporting them. And it sounds like a semantic thing, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Supporting means they're there to remove obstacles. They're there to facilitate their work, to make sure they can perform in their identities as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that works all the way down until it's no longer necessary, okay? Because the farther you get away from the top, the less value add you're actually doing. But it doesn't mean they're not necessary, right? You gotta find a way that you can balance all that stuff. That model, that transition, is difficult because it threatens a lot of people. But there are ways, like we always say this, hey, we're gonna keep the right attitudes, not necessarily the right skill sets. So we'll invest in attitude and potential 100 times over resume.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how we work. If you're good, you can figure out your role. You can figure out where we can fit you in to perform your best. And you're going to add value to the company. That's how we see it.
Somewhere in the Bible, I don't know where, you probably do, it says that the knowledge doesn't really matter, right? It's God's, right? God's the knowledge. The smart person, he always says, make the smart person foolish, right? And that's all. But what do we? How do we raise our kids? Go to school. Go to Harvard. Get all this stuff. It's wrong, right?
I'm sorry.
So I'm sitting here and listening to everything.
That's your book, by the way.
What
is
that
seat over there?
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
the
lazy boys. Yeah. So I'm sitting here listening to you guys, and this is this blowing my mind. But I'm a small business owner. I have less than 10 people that work on my team. and I started it myself. And I was all four of those things at one time. And I still am all four of those things. I operate in all four of those roles. And I have to heavily lean on the Lord to, as it, you know, and to help me through all of those things, because I don't feel like my identity or my gifting fits perfectly in all of those roles, right? So what advice would you give to someone who's just starting a company or who owns a small business who doesn't have the team or the people to fill all of those roles?
Yeah, so there's one other entity that fills all four of those roles, and I think you know what I'm talking about. It's possible to do that at a small scale, okay? But at a grand scale, you'll start to become a bottleneck. The way I would introduce this concept is to start having more collaborative meetings. And when decisions need to be made, you include the workforce in those decisions, right? That may be your style already. So stylistically, that may be working for you. But what I believe is going to happen is you're going to have the founder's dilemma as well. Everyone has that. There's a certain level of control that people are unwilling to give up. It's okay. There's resilience in your organization as long as you have the right team. So what I would encourage you to do is to include more people in your, not inner circle, but include more people in the decision making, right? That's the Kaizen process. It's utilizing all the brains in the room to come up with a better solution. The people that work for you, they're doing something. They're doing some craft,
sure,
that, and possibly doing it better than you can do yourself. So who better to ask them how to make their jobs better?
Yeah, they do it every day, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, hey, we got to cut costs 20%. You know, you're at home trying to figure all this out. I'll give you an example. When I was a young supervisor, I got this job, and they said, hey, you need to get more product out of this, whatever it was we were making. You need to get more product out of this. I was probably in my late 20s. So I was really smart. I was the smartest guy there. I'm this young rising star like Leon. So I got an engineer and I got all these smart people together. And we met in this the lunchroom. And the lunchroom was all glass. And you had to walk by there to go to the bathroom. And we were all in there. We had stuff written on the walls for days. Days we were doing this. Couldn't figure it out. So I'm in the restroom. And one of the operators that runs the machine came up next to me. And he said, what are you guys doing in there? He said, I noticed, you know, he saw some words he recognized. He said, oh, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to get 20. And he said, you know what you need to do is, I'm like, wait. So I drug him into the meeting room, and this is no joke, within 10 minutes. Mm. 10 minutes. And that's when I realized that I was not the smartest person in the room. And that's when I said, okay, we're going to do something totally different, right, moving forward. And the interesting part was I was trained to do that, but I wouldn't do it because of all the greed and the power and all that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I was trying to climb the ladder. Why would I do that? But that was an eye-opener for me. So
part of it in small business is empowering the people, because when you feel empowered, you have ownership.
Yeah,
and you're
right.
Invested in it.
That's right. So delegating, empowering people, that gives them ownership in their area. And it requires a specific culture to do that, because mistakes, no one intends to go to work to do a bad job. Well, I hope. I mean, no one typically goes to work to do something and make a mistake. So when it happens, let's figure it out. I mean, don't blame the person, blame the system. Blame the process. The process allowed this mistake to occur. Let's design it such that there's resilience in it and these mistakes don't happen again. So when they do happen, in a punitive organization, they're hidden. There are workarounds. Oh, this happened again. All what you got to do is this, knock it twice, and move this around, and start working again, right? They become band-aids that hold up the entire organization. There's so much inefficiency. And we can't afford that inefficiency, especially in this competitive marketplace. We've got to make sure that we can empower correctly, and when problems do arise, they're addressed in the right way, in a constructive way. Right?
You know, in the small businesses and in the large businesses, always look at the process, right? And then when you look at the process, get the people to actually do the job, right, and say, hey, let's redesign this. And then guess what? They own it, and you never have to worry about it, because they own the process. Right, you put metrics in. We always tell them at the end to say, we're going to have KPIs. Everyone know what a KPI is?
Yeah. Key performance indicator.
It's like I'm driving down the highway, and I do this often, and I'll be looking at something, and I kind of run off the road, and go, that's a KPI. It's an indicator that I'm going to run into the ditch. So all you need to do is put things in place that they can correct themselves. Because when I was a manager, I'm like, they would give me the financials. I'm like, you know, we lost $90. Why are you telling me now? Because it's gone. I can't do anything about it, right? So you got to have the KPIs in place. And then, but have them design. Have the people design. So they know how to check themselves.
Great questions, guys. Comments.
How much time we got?
5 minutes.
5 minutes?
Shoot. Who is threatened by the kingdom model? Who is threatened by this model, in your opinion?
CEO.
The CEO is threatened by it. That doesn't mean he's not participating. We can work that in, and again, this is a transition. Who else is threatened by this model?
Clients.
Clients can be threatened as well. If
my clients would be.
What is it that
you do?
I'm a real estate photography company owner. And if I am on a strict schedule every single day. I deal with real estate agents and I deal with their sellers. So I often think about, okay, if the Lord leads me to do this, and I say yes, that could affect the rest of my day. Right, and that could offend a lot of people.
Right. So there's a scale issue with yourself. It sounds like your bandwidth is pretty limited, and therefore assigning time is yes.
Yeah.
So this would be a deep discussion, but it'd be interesting to analyze like what portion of your day you spend managing things versus actually doing things, right? And figuring out if there's a way to balance that better, offload some of that work, etc. But I mean, you're right. Some of these changes might threaten the client, but those are the changes that we want to at least mitigate the risk as much as possible. Because that could be fatal to a business, right? This has to be done in a measured, prudent way, not just a, hey, this sounds great, let's go do this and make the guy do push-up, something like that. It's gotta be something more, you know, a prudent way of implementing it. But as long as you understand and grasp the theories, I think you can contextualize it in a way that makes sense for yourself. Okay.
Awesome.
Great. So that's the last slide. Any questions? Yes.
Are the shareholders threatened? I mean, ultimately, if you're improving, it might be a short-term pain for a long-term gain, but you might sell it to them, but it seems like they'd be threatened by seeing this. Because they're saying they lose control partially over how things are done and in the bottom line.
That's a very good question. We've taken away the two things that corrupt most businesses, and that is power and money. And by taking away the money piece of it, it threatens a lot of people. And the power especially as well, because that's a smaller population. But the money piece is pretty important. So there are people threatened on the shareholder side, because the short-term gain is...
Now, and now he wants to do this in order. So it's just, and again, it's a God thing.
Yeah.
And I've got to share the God part of this, right? So this originally started, there was two of us talking one day, saying, hey, we need to raise money to help people like Jim with the movie. You know, he's trying to make their TV series and all that kind of stuff. We need to, you know, raise money for that. I'm terrible at raising money.
You've got 30 seconds. So.
Oh, and
30 seconds. Sorry, that's your question.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then, so we get, you know, just, it's a, it, I don't know if any of you try to raise money, it's no fun. So we said, we start talking about, hey, what can we do, whatever. What are things are our talents? What are our talents? And yeah, we're both business people. And then we drug Leon in there, and we start talking about it. And said, hey, why don't we, and this sounds like the thing of Jonathan, but it's not. Why don't we use business to create the money to help fund these other things? That's how it started. And then it turned into the abundance model. Why not do it where everyone benefits from this, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's all God. So originally the plan was every year we buy a business, and we just started this year, late last year. We'll buy one business a year, and that's how we'll do it. Currently now we've got three, maybe four, and it's not even the end of the first quarter. And it's all God. And these people are showing up from California. This guy came from New Mexico. So part of this thing is the property management. One of the biggest problems is maintenance. They don't have enough maintenance or painters or fix the toilets and all that kind of thing. So this is spun off a new company, a maintenance company. So this guy just so happened to come from New Mexico that knew somebody was in town in Dallas. We met. Guess what?
He's a maintenance guy.
He's the guy.
Oh,
right.
Guy.
Then another guy from Florida, a handyman from Florida.
I mean, I just, you had said, like, this isn't for everybody. Is that just because people aren't open to it?
They're not ready.
When
we do consulting, we're not for everybody. We'll go on and say,
turned down clients before.
Yeah, say, these are our core values.
This
and
is
you
process.
Sure.
You guys are supposed to be on the panel. Oh,
shoot. Right, yeah.
Over a minute and a half?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks, guys.